imagine that you are sitting on top of a mountain that's overlooking a vast city. It's twilight. The sun has just set. You notice the lights coming on in the great city. You breathe the fresh mountain air. You hear the song of a bird. That little cricket. You feel the freshness of the grass under your hands. You look out over the city, it seems like a lake of lights. You're sitting there alone. Gazing at a beautiful spectacle, the stillness of twilight. What are you feeling? After a while, you hear footsteps behind you, and intuitively, you know that they are footsteps of a holy man who lives in these parts, a hermit. He comes up to you and stands by your side. He looks at you gently and says just one sentence to you. If you go down into the city tonight, you will find God. Having said this, he turns around and walks away. No explanations, no time for questions. You have the conviction that this man knows what he's talking about. How do you feel now? Do you feel like acting on his statement and going down into the city? Would you rather stay where you're at here on the mountaintop? Whatever you're feeling, there's something that pulls you. And I want you now to go down in the city and search for God. What do you feel as you go down into the city? You've now come to kind of the outskirts. You have to decide where you're going to go to search for God and find Him. Where do you decide to go? Somehow in the mystery of things, you sense you're going to meet God, like the hermit said. But where do you go? Perhaps you reflect on those words of Jesus. I was hungry. You gave me food. I was thirsty. You gave me a drink. I was naked. You gave me clothes. Where do you go? I think we'll stop there. Anyone have anything they'd like to share from, maybe it takes, I don't know. I think these fantasies, these trips can be tremendous as far as that. Story. Anything that, did you find God?
When the Holy Man came up to go down into the city to find God, and you asked at that juncture to do a couple of times, how do you feel?
Mm-hmm.
And, a very distinct feeling. It's a combination of feeling afraid. So in that old church, had you stayed for a while, you might have seen this old grandmother come in and watched her go through her rosary and saw the look on her face. I don't know what you might have seen.
And the light that came out.
Yeah.
Right, but I was busy looking at the architecture.
I know, right. That's right.
Yeah.
Anyone else have a...
In downtown Seattle, right across from the Greyhound bus station, there's a very, very beautiful Lutheran church, Gethsemane Lutheran Church. It's a very old church. And architecturally, it's beautiful. And it has a $300,000 organ in it. And it's the way in which it's laid out is office spaces over here, and then in the middle, between the large narthex and the chant worship area, there's a beautiful little atrium. There are flowers in there, and it's always kept very nicely. People who belong to that church are mostly people who live in the suburbs, and that's the church that they grew up in, and it's the mother church for many other churches around the area. And about 6 months ago, after a long struggle within the congregation, they opened up the doors of their church at night for 15 to 20 homeless women. And we always have the Compass Center has its board of directors meetings at Gethsemane Lutheran Church on the third Thursday of the month. So every time we meet there, and of course I have an opportunity to meet some of the women and to see the way in which they have found home. at least for shelter at night. And the way in which that church just seems to be completely different. Mm-hmm. With their magnificent facility, mm-hmm. and their beautiful stained glass and their atrium. But now there are real people there, and God seems to be much more present. It's just a change. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think the congregation has changed. The second Sunday of July, they had a picnic out in the big parking lot that they own. The church, the congregation owns this huge parking lot. And of course the parking lot is rented or is leased out to a big parking firm, Republic Parking or something like that, down there. And of course that's the way the congregation gets a lot of its income, through the leasing of the parking lot. But on this Sunday, the parking lot was reserved for a church picnic. And everybody was invited, and so quite a number of homeless people also came to the picnic. And the first time this has ever happened, mm-hmm. where the members of the parish and homeless people gathered together in the parking lot, mm-hmm. for a shared meal. Mm-hmm. But this is the way in which God changes things, through, I believe, the Spirit's presence in the lives of people, to find God.
When I was sitting on the hill and you said footsteps came from behind and you intuited that it was a holy person, and he said one sentence, I think he paused and my thought was, what would he say to me? Mm-hmm. What would he say to me? Mm-hmm. And it would have been interesting to stop and to reflect on, what would he say to me today at 10:45? What would he say?
I don't know how long you're going to be here. Are you here for a while?
Till Monday.
Right. I mean, you got 3 days to
work. Yeah.
Right. Wonderful. That's such an important question.
Yeah.
And as you go and walk outside, it seems to me, or talk with other people, or go for a walk or hike, that maybe that's a really important question.
Mm-hmm. And somehow to allow God to speak. Because this whole thing is a faith experience. Mm-hmm. And I have found, especially in times of quietness and meditation, if I just kind of let the words come, mm-hmm. that it's kind of a uniqueness of God speaking. I think back of Bernard Shaw's play of Joan of Arc, and people say, well, you know, these visions and that you have, it's just your imagination. She smiles, she's, how else does God speak to me?
Mm-hmm. And then to be able to hear, to move in the process of life, to learn to hear. Because mm-hmm. it's one thing for him to say, it's another for us not just to hear, but also to listen, or whatever those words are. And to be able to do it on the hillside, and to be able to do it in the city.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay, we're wrestling a little bit with the theology about Jesus, and the teaching of the lifestyle, the theology of Jesus. So if I take seriously, I've been picking up some of these 25-cent books in the library, I found some gems. Of things I want to read, but you know, they're out of print, so you can't get them. And I've always wanted to know a little more about Soderblom. And I thought I'd like to look at kind of a little one on Richard Niebuhr. I took one up on Grundtvig. Grundtvig's fascinated me, but I've never really gotten a real feel of him. But as I opened up these two little books, one on Niebuhr and another on Soderblom, they both had the same quote from St. John Chrysostom. And the first page,
And the quote from Chrysostom was, "He who praises a man ought to follow him. And if he is not ready to follow him, he ought not to praise him."
Wonderful.
Quite.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Isn't that?
Yeah, it's great.
I mean, so it makes us change the question about why am I at church?
That's right. Yeah.
Am I here to praise the Lord?
Right.
And to follow?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it goes back to Jesus, and it goes to Chrysostom, and it goes to Niebuhr, and you know, his insights, and Soderblom, and learning from each other, following. Yeah.
I'd like to say, when you were talking about picturing yourself on the hillside and everything, how peaceful it was, and how restful you were, and how comfortable you were. You didn't want to move. If I was in that spot, I'd just want to sit there, maybe take a nap, not go into the city. And so when he says to go into the city, you know, or he says in the city you'll find God, at that point you're just like, well, why should I leave this comfortable place to find God? I mean, you want to, you know, like you were saying, you got that exciting feeling, and you felt that, I felt that I had to, that for sure I was going to.
Yeah.
But I had to leave this comfortable place to do it, and that is an unsettling feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of a struggle there.
But that's wonderful, interesting struggle that you went through.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that the whole direction is that you leave the city to find God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, that I come to Holden Village to find God, I come to the mountains to find God, and here I will find something. And you've got the tension of it all, and you're right at that moment, you know.
Yeah. And then, of course, you take the other terms of Jesus. When he's tired and needs that solitude, he finds a way, and he even leaves his disciples sometimes on guard so it's not interrupted. So I guess what I'm saying then is, if I want to follow him, and if I want to live in a hectic society, that maybe I have to find those holy places. I'm not sure. I think it might be different for different people, but for Jesus there were those special spaces. It might be a mountaintop, it might be a garden, it might be the home of Mary and Martha. There are Native Americans, they had those holy spaces.
Mm-hmm.
They went on their quest and then, yeah, go ahead.
Remember reading that a little bit about what the meaning of the term follow me,
mm-hmm.
that Jesus put to us,
mm-hmm.
what that means, and the distinction between understanding that as believing in him,
mm-hmm.
versus believing with him, and believing and having faith as with and as he had his faith.
Mm-hmm.
And if I look at that second and deeper sense of it,
mm-hmm.
And I look at if I was with him, or if I believed as he believed, lived the religious life as he lived it. Of course, I couldn't live it exactly, but if I emulated that, there were times when he went away and went off by himself and refueled,
mm-hmm.
was deeply inspired and fed and nourished and strengthened to return to serve.
Okay.
And to love and to minister.
Mm-hmm.
And in my meager experience, there's really that ebb and flow. There's the intake, the energization there, energizing.
Yeah.
And then going back, and the love that pours out to people has to come from somewhere. It's coming in from the relationship with God, but they're going out to get the love.
I like, I forget exactly where it is, it's the Ecclesiasticus, but it's a good one for some of us busy people.
Mm-hmm.
There is no meaner person than the person that's mean to themselves. how can the person that's mean to themselves do good for any? And I've used that fairly often with people that are really uptight. I mean, they're doing so many things, they're good people, they're concerned people, but you can just feel that tension. They need somebody to say, back away, be good to yourself so that you can serve graciously.
It's the relationship between nourishment and exercise or energy output.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like someone who only eats just becomes bloated and dies, and someone who only acts and doesn't eat wastes away.
Yeah.
What are some of the things about Jesus that become a real challenge to you as far as your life's journey? And then maybe some things that you just had fun with, because I think God thinks it's okay to have fun with some of them.
Jesus asks me if I would listen, to reach out and do things that I'm not comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
They're scary.
Take risks.
Take risks.
Save risks.
Social risks.
Let's do it. Yeah.
To talk to people that I don't know. And one of those times when I listen and gather an encouraging act on it, I never fail to be rewarded by some wonderful experience.
Yeah.
So that's the. I think Jesus challenges me, because that's what he did.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Kind of interesting. One of the reactions of some of the street people, especially from down in Occidental Park, is how your colleagues accept you. I mean, here you are down here talking to us, you know, drug dealers and addicts and prostitutes, you know. You know, this isn't the church. What do they accept you? Are you really one of them? Which is kind of now. Then you think of friend of publicans and sinners. And if we maybe don't know the owner of the bar a block away from our church. Jesus maybe have something to say to us? Or if we don't know any of the barmaids? Or any of the people that stop in there? Especially if some people would get unhappy if we did? I started a great ministry just serendipitously because when I first came to Emmanuel Lutheran. Just because I like doing things different, I like walking the shortest routes, and I stopped in very, very early in my ministry there, a little bar down the way, a little cafe and bar, and had a cup of coffee. When I was through with the coffee, I should have gone out the front door and down the church, but instead I walked back through and out the side door where the bar was. And I walked in there, and the owner looked up, and the bartender, like, what the hell is this new clergy person doing here? I made the sign of the cross and said, I just wanted to stop through and bless you fellows before you start your day's work. And they thought that was the neatest thing that had ever happened. One year I had more adult baptisms out of the people from that bar than all the rest of the congregation. Now, friend of publicans and sinners. And not so long afterwards, there was a murder down there. I married this fellow a little later, and his wife. But a burglar came in, and they came, burglary going on, and she screamed. And the burglar shot and killed Joe.
husband.
Yeah. And it was the biggest funeral I had in that church. There were wheelchairs, there were long, he happened to be the youngest quarterback at the University of Washington at Cal. Sports people, law, just the whole cross section. And then after the service, we went down to the little tavern and had kind of a wake, you know. And I was helping bartend out in front. The whole counter was a bar. And the word came from the back, hey, send that padre back here where the real drinkers are. And I went back there, and here's some judges and a few other people. From that day, as long as I was at Emmanuel, there wasn't a month where there wasn't some interaction out of that. You know, Joe almost became a patron saint. And somebody asked them as they were walking down to the church, do all you people belong to his church? And his wife says, no, I think he joined us.
That's great. It's so incarnational, right?
Yeah.
He joined us.
Yeah. And when we were trying to put some protection for these old stained glass windows, a good windstorm, some of them were going to end up on the parking lot. And we were a poverty church trying to do a bunch of stuff. I would often go down to the bar on Friday and get more money for the window fund from the bar jar than we'd get on our offerings for the for protecting the windows.
I want to go back to your earlier question. I don't know if I remember my answer. I was thinking about how in the last few years of my life, I began to think about life as adventure.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were always things that I dreaded to do, or people I dreaded to meet, and now I begin to say, no, this is an adventure. and God is with me in this adventure. So let's go out and find out what's there in the adventure. See? I was thinking about we had a discussion last night, I don't know if you were there, about the future and all that cool stuff, eh?
Yeah.
Hope for the future.
Yeah.
And I never said it, you know, but afterwards I went home to my room and I thought about it. And I sort of said, well, you know, regardless of whether the future looks dark and gloomy, it still is an adventure.
Right.
And we can hang our heads and bemoan the fact that we may not all collect our Social Security, or that we may end up in poverty or whatever, but it's still an adventure. Our kids can sit around and moan because they might not be able to find a job, and then all that depression happens and all that kind of stuff. But it seemed to me that we could begin to think about how Jesus calls us into this adventure. And that our life is an adventure, and it will take us just enormously strange places, but that somehow in those strange places, and then finally we have to go through the wonderful adventure of dying.
Yes.
I'm not particularly anxious that it would come, but it also is an adventure.
I say three good jokes for the last hour, and I hope I can move slow enough into the exit so I can share those three really good jokes. My last gift.
Your last gift.
But, you know, another thing to think about is maybe with that, what we consider the final adventure, maybe that's just the entree to the real adventure.
Well, that's right. I mean, what a wonderful way. I had a funeral. A woman who, she was very ill through the 10 years she'd been in the parish. She'd been ill through the whole time. Comes to church once in a while, and then she had multiple stuff happening to her. And finally she was dying. And the doctor knew it, and so I went to see her, and I said, I understand that you're going to die. And she said, that's right. And she said, "But you, you know, you better start working on my funeral service."
Mm-hmm.
"And because I'm going to be up there listening to you, and I want a good one."
Great. Great.
Oh, great. And I said, "Oh, well, you know, I've been thinking about preaching a hell and damnation sermon at the funeral." And she looked at me and said, "That'd be nice, Don. I always wanted to go out with a bang."
Oh.
And I thought, well, here's a woman for whom this, you know, she died 2 days later.
Yeah.
But here's a woman for whom somehow this was also an adventure.
Oh, sure.
And she said to herself, she said to me, "I'm not worried about myself. I just know that I'm with God. So I don't worry about that. I worry about my family that I'm leaving, my husband and my children. But I don't worry about myself." And I sort of said, "Wow, if I can have that kind of sense in my life, eh?"
Yes.
Not only in my death, but in my life, that somehow, no matter what's happening to me, that it is in some ways an adventure for us.
See, that is to me integral to this question of the religion of Jesus and the faith of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
He lived it in such faith,
yeah,
that it was all an adventure.
Yeah.
There was nothing to be afraid of,
yeah,
in any of it.
No, even going to Jerusalem was an adventure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
And I mean, I mean, it seems to me that's what the church will discover as we move into the future, even though it may look black for us, eh?
Mm-hmm.
That we could discover this wonderful adventure.
Darkest hour is fourth dawn.
Yeah.
Here's what the expert on Jesus should, from a scholarly point, written. And this is what he wrote, Jesus and then the Christ.
Who's the author?
Oh, this is just Nolan, but it's great. But he quotes Skillebex. And I think of this because Jim Douglas, who, how long did he spend in jail because for his peace efforts?
Oh.
And he goes, "I'm going to put this kind of time in. I need to know really why I'm doing it." So he got both volumes of Skillebex. Jesus. If this is what happens when you follow him, I got to get better acquainted. As Skillebex has so aptly put it, "The fact that Jesus' disciples did not fast witnesses to the existential impossibility of being sad in the company of Jesus." The fact that they don't fast.
Mm-hmm.
"Witnesses to the existential impossibility of being sad," mm-hmm, "in the company of Jesus."
Always in that adventure experience. Yeah. What a great adventure, exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Don't, you know, just...
When I was in South Africa, I met this Lutheran priest. He was under the ban, which meant, during the time of apartheid, which meant that he was unable to speak publicly to anyone. You were only supposed to be with one person at a time.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you were even supposed to eat alone or only with one person. So that if you were a family member, you weren't even to eat with your family, but you were to be alone. You could walk the streets, but you could only talk to one person at a time. Anyway, this priest was under the ban. And he was the happiest guy I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
He laughed and laughed as he talked to me. And he told me, he said, "Well, what happens to me is that I'm under the ban, so eventually I'm now out of prison for a while. So I kind of rest and get my act together. And then I start to be a parish pastor, and even a parish priest again. And I preach and I celebrate Eucharist, and they all discover that, and then they throw me back in prison again. So then I'm in prison, and then I become the prison chaplain." and then I minister to all the black people who are in prison, and so that no matter where I go, I'm still doing the work of Jesus.
Right, eh? Right, yeah, yeah.
And I said, "Well, how did you come to this point of having such wonderful abandonment about his life. And he said, well, he had been in prison and was working with the prisoners and creating some stir, and they had thrown him in the pit. And the pit was in the middle of the prison yard, corrugated steel over the top, and you then sit in this hole that is about 3 feet deep, and the sun beats down on the corrugated steel, and he was there for a month, and eating very little, and receiving little water, and he said, I thought I would die. In fact, I was sure I was going to die. And then he said, and in facing the fact of my death, I came to to another reality.
Yeah.
That when I realized that death was not the end of all of everything, and could face my death, now I can face life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a wonderful story.
Yes.
I mean, I kind of wish that for myself, that that seems to me to be the sort of sense about an adventure and so on.
Yes, and that's exactly what I believe is the theology of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was that you can grasp that and then make it your own.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can face every day as an exciting opportunity in the future.
All right. Because they look at it, like, what's the worst thing that can happen? I can die. Well, that's not so bad.
Exactly.
We all have that to look forward to.
It's not the end.
If I die, it's going to be
a good time. Kind of thankful during World War II, our submarine went down. There's a room for a mistake on the submarine. You make one, you can get in trouble. And when we fired the torpedo, you let the water come in and compensate for the weight of the torpedo that's just left. Keep your ballast down there. And one torpedoman, first class, veteran, left one valve open. So instead of the water just flooding into the torpedo tube, it flooded the whole of forward trim, and our boat just went down like that. And deep we've never been. I said to the fellow on the stern planes, I happened to be on the bow plane, I said, I'm glad we got a soft bottom to hit. I didn't know where the bottom was exactly, but I knew it was soft. Then a half mile further north, it'd still be there. Well, my first reaction was, I'm glad God and I are friends. And the second one, you gotta go, a $9 million coffin ain't bad.
$9 million
coffin. That's me, you know, kind of religious but kind of materialistic. I reflect back on that, it's just kind of fun.
I got one that your thought about the woman preaching like doing the eulogy, you know, hellfire or something. Remember hearing one of my fundamentalist preachers, Karen Forth, talking about hellfire and brimstone, and there will be wailing, there will be gnashing of teeth, and playing in the back this little old lady who didn't have any teeth. She said, "Man, I don't have any teeth." Madam Teeth will be provided.
Well, see, one of the things I think in terms of why it's, I think there's a new emphasis again in terms of some of the value of continuing to search for the historical Jesus alongside of the other. I happened to pick up a copy of Schweitzer's sermons. His confirmation sermon at St. Nicholas, one of the greatest confirmation service and sermons I've ever heard. But Christ invites us into abundant living. Full living, meaningful living, and to see the challenge as something to experiment with and to follow that way, and to enter into full life. It's not that heavy, it's not that sad sack, it's not that bad type of quietism. It's exciting. Mm-hmm. I was walking just about a week ago down the waterfront, and this one old
homeless guy sitting over there. He's just in that big smile. I thought, I gotta go find out what it is. I go over and says hi. And I said something about his smile and all that. And he says, yeah, it's so wonderful. He says, every day I get a chance to talk to somebody about God. That was his joy.
Wow.
It doesn't even cost much.
Two weeks ago, I had an experience very similar to this with Jean Marie. I mentioned, I told you a little bit about this. She was dying of alcoholism at Harborview Hospital, which is the public assistance hospital in Seattle. And she had been in the hospital about 10 days, and her liver had stopped functioning. Kidneys were given out, and her body was just as yellow and bloated as you could ever imagine. And she was on Friday when I went up to see her, which was just 2 weeks ago today. She was just kind of with it. Otherwise, they had her very heavily doped up with intravenous morphine and so forth and so. But that day, Friday, when I saw her, she was just really hurt, and she was feeling really sorry for herself. And she knew she was going to die, and I knew this, and her husband knew it, and I had known them for about 2 years. I had married the couple 2 years before, and both Jim and Jean Marie had been sometime or other homeless, and Jean Marie because of alcoholism, and Jim because he tagged along with her all the time, and he wanted her there. And he, of course, provided an awful lot of the booze for her, and so he was just filled up with guilt and everything else. And she was just really feeling sorry for herself. She says to me, she says, Jim, she says, today is just not a good day for me. I've just been sitting on my pity pot all day. And I told her, I said, well, Jean Marie, that's okay. You can sit on your pity pot, but just remember that you're not sitting there by yourself. You got somebody sitting right next to you. And then she looked at me and she said, you mean, Jim, there's a two-holer there? That is tremendous.
I remember that one.
And the next day she died. Yeah. Just died, and with surrounded by the loving arms of God. And there was no fear there, but she did fear for her husband, Jim, mm-hmm. who had just oodles and oodles and heaps of guilt, because he had gone out every day and bought her anywhere from 1 to 2 fifths of booze a day and allowed her to. But this is what many spouses do, who are a codependent partner.
You know, one of the most amazing things about hearing the two of you talk about the ministry down there, and I'm really not exposed to the echelons of society that you are, is that it really breaks apart my stereotypes. I mean, my stereotypes of homeless people and alcoholics, in fact, the late stage alcoholism, is that there's just not much there.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. And what I'm hearing you say is that these people are spiritually very much alive, even though they're in the midst of late stages of a disease that they should have their brains totally pickled. They're there, and they're really interacting with God. And they're just, that really breaks my spirit.
He wants to meet one of the fellows that I think is what I'm supposed to say is I know that very likely won't live out the year. Come down and meet Marcus.
Yeah.
Marcus.
Marcus.
Yeah. I don't get
Marcus.
He might live another year, but I doubt it. I think of the influence he has had for good, for faith, for in the lives of countless young people. Kids from Montana come, and the first question they ask is, how's Marcus? He is a saintly person.
Is he someone who has been involved in 12-step stuff and just not?
Well, he's had times of sobriety, but and he has some absolutely beautiful stories that come out. He's never made it. We've made it for short terms.
Yeah.
But, man.
The guys, we were at a group meeting in our church, mm-hmm. and the guys say, 30% of us make it.
Yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And maintain sobriety.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That the majority of people maintain sobriety for a period of time, and once they start coming to AA, and it's for usually a period of about 3 to 5 years,
mm-hmm.
and then they're gone again.
Yeah.
And for many people, they never return, that they just live out their whole life in alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I suppose it's really easy for us to sort of to become judgmental then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
sure.
kind of take on our, oh, you have to look after your body, beautiful, all that kind of crap stuff. I mean, no, good stuff, but then to become judgmental and say, hey, these are not people anymore,
right.
because they've got this disease.
Right.
And
sure.
That there isn't normal spiritual or mental function going on.
That's right.
Right. Or that they don't need God, or that God is not with them, or that forgiveness is not theirs every day, even in the midst of a fairly abusive and oppressive life. But surely that's not what we talk about in baptism.
No.
Right?
No.
It's not
like baptism. See, I'm used to thinking my model for alcoholism is that it's rife with denial. That it's a constant, and I've got a partial sense of it. I'm finding out
mm-hmm.
that it's a life lived trying to hide from reality, and the booze is an adjunct to that. And they, well, what I'm hearing you say is that when these folks come up for air, they're very spiritually alive.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Well, even when they don't come up for air, in the midst of the darkness, I've heard the talk of adventure and all of those things in life, and there is that dimension that Christ calls us to make our joy complete.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'm concerned that how do we understand that joy? At the one time we are people who are given new life each day, but at the same time we are people who are broken clay pot vessels.
Right.
And our denial, though it may not be alcohol, oftentimes comes in denying the fact that we are broken vessels,
mm-hmm.
and oftentimes that life means we live through processes of grief and through processes of loss, and to be free and comfortable to experience and to express that pain and sorrow without feeling that I need to be on, in a shallow sense, unadventurous or full of joy,
mm-hmm.
I think robs us from a deep spirituality, for grace oftentimes comes through the painfulness
mm-hmm.
of the experience of the brokenness. And to deny ourselves that journey, or to say that it isn't appropriate, or that we are somewhat less spiritual, I think is flying in the face of the depth of the gospel that Jesus reaches to us in our brokenness, and not just at a place where we can live with the wage not balancing too hard against the boat.
Mm-hmm.
So I get concerned about that as I experience grief in my own life, and as I see it in others, that we not try to have a happy day then to death, pretend as we are children of hope, which we are, but we are broken, and we need to face that.
Right.
In a balance, in a perspective.
But when I say adventure,
yes.
I don't mean happy.
Right. No.
Because, I mean, I'm a person who suffers from depression, and and I've been in it 3 times now, and always in danger of going down again.
Mm-hmm.
Come December, when the darkness comes,
mm-hmm.
it's a threat to me, eh?
Right.
And I have to be very careful with myself. But after the second time, I couldn't after the first time because it was I was so frightened by it all.
Mm-hmm.
I was very frightened by my depression. I thought I would never come out of it. I'd have to live out my life living in this kind of gloom and doom for the rest of my life. And I knew that I didn't want to do this. But after the second time, I kind of began to say, well, God, so you're leading me in this adventure too.
Yeah, sure.
And it too is a part of the fullness of life.
Right.
And it's hard to know. I mean, is there some purpose even in this?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the one thing that that I discovered for myself is that when I started to come clean with my parish about how I am in depression and it's a difficult time for me, that all of a sudden everybody in that, I mean a lot of other folk in the parish began to say, well, me too, me too. And there's just a bunch of people who started to come out in the open about how this was a part of their life as well and a part of their struggle. And so that in the midst of all that, we're met with wonderful grace. Hey?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's easy for any group to speak of the good, the success, the joy, the satisfaction, the fruitfulness of your ministry in the kingdom of God. How easy is it for professionals or wannabes or whoever to say, I am feeling weak and broken, and things aren't well with me, things aren't well with my vocation, with my occupation, with my parish, or whatever, to be able to say, things suck right now, or whatever, and then to be able to see the gracefulness of God in that, and not feel that the only way we can is to portray something that maybe is not reality.
Yeah.
But there's such pressure on us to portray the other.
No.
That's sad.
Doesn't Jesus lead us into that too?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he sits with us on the two holes. Yeah.
But I mean, even looking at his life.
Yeah. I wonder if it's possible to think in terms of something I read a couple of days ago. The kingdom of God, that all of us are a part of that, but if we could take out the G in the word kingdom and make it the kingdom of God, that all of us are in this gracious family, this grace-filled, abundant family where there is everybody has an opportunity to see the light and walk in the light, and as long as we're walking in toward the light, as Francis Marvin's wife said this morning in our Humanities Devotion, as long as you're walking toward the light, the darkness can't catch up to you.
Yeah.
There will be dark times. Mm-hmm. There will be dark times.
Yes.
But it won't overwhelm you, overtake you and suck you in.
We have, I suppose, traditionally in our church got this, you know, who's going to make it kind of complex. And I was a college student when we were at a nursing home and this talking to this old guy, and he looked at me and said, you know, I had a dream last night. I said, oh, gee, I dreamt I was in heaven. Oh. He says, you know who was there? I says, no. He says, everyone that really wanted to be there.
That's good.
I was thinking there's some people who don't want to be. They've gnashed their teeth all their life at other people.
Yeah.
Wouldn't they have? They won't be happy. So God in His mercy has provided them a place where they just go on gnashing their teeth at people. Until maybe they all wear down.
And then they'll get a new pair.
No. This morning in the Bible study, we were talking about first coming, second coming stuff, eh? And we use that in our language a lot, first coming, second coming.
Yeah.
And I said, well, it seems to me that there's three comings. There's the first coming, and that's the point where Jesus came and was birthed. The second coming is when Jesus meets us in our everyday life, like the Lord among us. And the third coming is the final coming of the kingdom of God. But we only talk in the church of two comings. But right now, what we're talking about is the coming of Jesus in our everyday life with grace. Eh?
Right. Yeah.
And how are we going to change our language? Because it seems to me that wonderful story of the two people on the road to Emmaus is a wonderful sign of people in important conversation and in grieving.
Exactly. Yeah.
And in the midst of that, the Lord is present. It took them quite a while to recognize the presence of the Christ with them in that kind of thing. And it often does for us too. It takes us a long time. Mm-hmm. But that somehow we, I don't think we do talk about this enough, about how this Christ is present with us to bring us God's grace on a daily basis, and therefore a part of our task is precisely what you said in terms of meditation, you know, to look for this Christ in our daily life.
And I think it's great. I think it's not being overly mystical or anything else to, at the end of the day, to kind of reflect and say, what did it happen today? Mm-hmm. What were those kind of peak experiences? Mm-hmm. It may have been a relationship to nature. It may have been in terms of people. Who knows? But it is happening.